Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on the show, we'll speak with one of the pioneers of the urban farming movement. Will Allen is a native of Rockville, Maryland, where he grew up on a small farm. And after a career in the NBA, Allen returned to his roots, so to speak, in agriculture. He's the first to develop what he calls vertical agriculture. And no, the vertical doesn't refer to his 6'7" height. Instead, he maximizes farm productivity on small plots of inner city land by stacking levels of plants and aquaculture on top of one another. His organization, Growing Power, operates farms in Milwaukee and Chicago and offers training programs to help foster a new generation of farmers. Then, on Delmarva correspondent Tom Horton joins us to offer his homage to spring. Up first, here's Will Allen. He visited Baltimore to deliver a lecture at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and I sat down with him at their offices. I asked him to talk about his dedication to food justice and why the movement towards organic agriculture often leaves a significant portion of the population behind.
Well, one of the problems with our food system is that hardly very few people understand the food that they eat. They don't understand all aspects of, even though they think they're eating healthy, they don't have a measuring stick for what they put in their system because most of the food comes from far away. A lot of it's already starting to lose a lot of its nutrient value. You know, whether you buy it from, you know, those really expensive retailers that we have, it may be 7-8 days old before you get it into your belly because, you know, the shipping time, you know, it gets picked, it gets stored out in the coast, and then that journey to, say, Maryland is about a 3-day journey because of the rules of the road. It goes to a wholesaler, sits in their cooler until the grocer calls and have it delivered to the store. It sits in the cooler at the grocery store before it comes out on the shelf. We come and purchase it, you know, unsuspecting us walk into these stores, and they've done a great job on the displays where they have the proper lights and they got the misters, and the stuff is just aesthetically displayed, and we think we're just gone to heaven and, you know, died and gone to heaven. It looks so good, I got to grab this stuff. But there are some things we don't know. And what we don't know is who grew that food. How was it really grown? Whether it has that organic label on it or not. Who grew it? How old is it really? Nobody in that store can tell you because they don't have the knowledge. So we buy it based on our looks because 84% of us buy based on the aesthetics of the product. You could have some product sitting next to it that doesn't look so good, and what are people going to do? They're going to go to the stuff that looks good, regardless of whether it's dripping in, you know, chemicals or whatever, you know. We don't care. Mm-hmm. We don't want to know. We trust that our food is safe and good, but we know over the last few years what has happened. We've had all those food scares almost once a month. You hear about something contaminated, whether it's beef or peppers or tomatoes.
Spinach.
And once we destroyed a tomato crop in Florida because we thought the contamination came from tomatoes a couple of years ago, and it came from jalapeno peppers and somewhere else. So we don't have a very good system of food safety in this country because we cut back in terms of the people that inspect everything that we get. So that's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is the fact that we've gone to this centralized system of where our food is grown, and we've gone away from where we were in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, where the majority of our food in Maryland was grown in Maryland that we sourced at grocery stores. But we don't have that situation in Wisconsin or Illinois or many of the major states. Iowa, for example, 85% of the food in 1950 was grown in the state of Iowa. Now it's, you know, less than 15%, simply because we've changed the way we farm from sustainable, diversified, integrated farms to a system where most Iowans grow soybeans, corn, or large-scale animal operations. Instead of that farm, 200 acres, where a farmer had raised some pigs, raised some chickens, raised some vegetables, you know, maybe did, you know, some soybeans, the old conventional kind of way, non-GMO kind of soybean operation, where you actually had to till the fields, you know, and cultivate and so forth, you know. So,
do you think that we can, do you think it's economically feasible for us to go forward to a system that's similar to that, that can feed us again? Have we gone too far to the kind of corporate industrial farms to kind of allow us to get to a place where farmers on a smaller scale can actually feed the nation? Do you think that's possible?
Well, the UN reports on food and so forth talk about, even their reports, where at one point we were supposed to be able to feed the world with this industrialized system, but we have more hunger than ever before. So the UN has actually made statements saying that a sustainable food system, a local food system, in countries where we're losing millions of people each year to bad water and bad food in Africa and other countries, that we need to, only way to end world hunger is a local food system. So is it possible? I believe it's possible in time, but we gotta get started now. We have to quantify a lot of things in terms of what is it going to take, in terms of how do we use the space that's available in cities and rural areas on the fringe of cities. How do we use vacant buildings to do aquaponics and aquaculture? Because, you know, right now 50% of our fish is farm-raised. In 5 years, it'll be up to 75% because of what we've done environmentally to the oceans, streams, and rivers, and so forth. So it's a tremendous opportunity for young entrepreneurs to go into business, because a lot of people who didn't come from farm backgrounds are now interested in food systems work, but not necessarily doing it the way that their fathers or grandfathers or great-grandfathers and mothers did their farming in row crops and so forth. They're more interested in a integrated food system that includes things like renewable energy, things like architecture in terms of vertical farms. And so there's so many hundreds of different jobs that are going to be created by this new system. But we need to get started on it now. And what we're doing in Milwaukee is really showing, demonstrating in a very concrete way that this can be done, that this can be cash flowed. Because why would I want to go into a business that I'm going to lose money? So we have to prove that this works. We can't just make assumptions. We know the other system doesn't work for farmers. The only thing that helps those farmers are price supports. The only reason they're in business is price supports. So we need to help the sustainable farmers get change where our tax dollars go to build a system that really is sustainable. And I believe the only system that we can have is a local, sustainable food system. Go back to the days where food was much healthier. Our soil today is 50% less fertile than it was in 1950. So we're starting at 50% less fertile. So how do we get that fertility back in the soil? we're throwing all the food waste into the landfills. So what we do is we compost. We grow soil.
In Milwaukee, at your farm?
Yeah, we grow soil. This year we'll do 22 million pounds of food waste and carbon waste.
22 million pounds?
Yeah. So we compost every day. We collect from 40 different sites. So we divert a lot of that food waste from the big green truck. You know who those guys are.
Right.
We divert that food waste, and we have a four-acre composting. So we have several composting sites, but our biggest one is a four-acre site where we compost every day.
Is this in the city itself?
It's right on the outside of the city. And so the city that I live in Oak Creek, Wisconsin.
So instead of it going to the landfills where it becomes methane that pollutes the atmosphere and creates global warming, you're creating compost out of what would then...
We have an ideal site because I negotiated a contract with our sewage district that had three large lagoons that hadn't been used for 20 years. So we're in a place on a lakefront that already smells because they're processing our sewage.
Right.
But this is a separate site. They have about a couple hundred acre site down there. And I was able to negotiate a contract with those folks to use that site. It's a secured space. You actually have to go through training to be able to go on the site. So it's run by Veolia, which is a French...
transportation company, right?
They're one of the waste haulers, and they do a lot of environmental kind of run. They run sewage plants all over the world and so forth, so... But it's owned by the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District that we have a great relationship with because we use a lot of their land to grow food as well that they purchase. They purchase land to be able to have that land to protect against runoffs and so forth.
So let me take a step backwards for a minute, to kind of talk about the what you've done, what's been created, what you worked to creating in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. You started this like in 1993, right?
93 is when I bought the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee. Of course, I had been farming
before you'd been
prior
farming.
To that. Yeah. Yeah, I've been farming in Wisconsin about 35 years. So. And I bought this property as a for-profit to be able to sell my farm produce. When I ran across this place, it was wound up being the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee.
Farm inside the city limits.
Yeah,
but because your history of farming goes back to when you were playing ball as a kid and your father making you work on his little farm
in Rockville,
here in Maryland.
Yeah.
And then when you were a basketball player, even in Belgium, you
were... When I left to go away to college at the University of Miami, I said, never again will I farm.
Now look at you.
And then I got over to Europe, and one of my European teammates' family had a farm. I went out one day, I touched the soil, and that was it. I wanted to farm again.
It was so, back inside. It was you.
Yeah. So there was something, hidden passion that I had that kind of...
So you started this farm in Milwaukee. Talk about how you... So this is in 93.
Right. And it was... for selfish reasons of selling my farm produce that I grew out. I had 100 acres of production out in Oak Creek and about 45 minutes away, and I was looking for a place I could set up a retail store, and the place came with greenhouses, old broken-down greenhouses that I had to rehab. So it took didn't have cashed in my retirement and got a loan. Somehow a bank gave me a loan to make the purchase. I fooled a bank, what can I say? It's obviously a very risky business, but banks were a lot more... It's a lot easier back then than it is today to get a loan, you know. But at any rate, along a continuum, I built it into what it is today. It was a transformative moment. After 2 years, I helped a youth group who wanted to grow an organic garden. And I had land in the back of the facility that I wasn't using at the time, and I helped them, and we got a big article, front page article in Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And that kind of launched us into this nonprofit. My friend said, since you like doing this, why don't you start a nonprofit? So I said, well, I don't want to sit at a desk and write grants, and I know nothing about nonprofit. And they said, well, we'll do it, you know. Famous last words.
Right, 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 exactly.
So that's how I got sucked into working with kids. And it's grown into what it is today, which is an organization that has over 100 employees.
100 employees working in agriculture in the city of Milwaukee.
And, well, we have farms in Chicago, 5 farms in Chicago, 1 in Madison.
Because your daughter helps run, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And we're going to be hiring 150 more people in the next year. So it's grown into, and we have 15 regional training centers around the U.S. working with other organizations to help them build the infrastructure to replicate what we're doing. Soon to be 20 this year. We're going to add 5 more.
So a lot of the people who are hired are people from Milwaukee, people from poor working class communities, inner city neighborhoods?
Well, some, I would say the majority, but we have people from all over the country that we hire. Very diverse group of folks that we have. Every culture you can think of working for Growing Power. And that's one of the things that I wanted to be able to have is a diverse workforce, and which brings diversity into our place with our 15,000 visitors a year and our trainings to train over 1,000 farmers a year and so forth. So I think our place really mirrors what I think the U.S. is going to be in the future in terms of the diversity and people working together and, you know, learning from each other. It's what farming has always been, passing on in a very hands-on way. So it's not sitting in a classroom. I've never seen a farmer learn how to farm sitting in a classroom. So I don't understand when organizations say, we're going to train some farmers, and they're never out in the field training those farmers. That's the only way I know how to do it. So so I think we're a little bit different than other organizations that have attempted to do this in terms of the amount of moving along a continuum and building a food system that we now do over 70 different things, from food policy work to pretty large scale, over 200 acres of production that we have now.
200 acres of production.
Yeah. And we're going to go to about 100 acres of greenhouses, hoop houses that we build every day. We build hoop houses every day.
You build your
day.
Own hoop houses?
Yeah.
So it doesn't cost you. So it doesn't cost you like $100,000 or $50,000 bucks a hoop house?
Oh, no. About $3,500 for
how much?
The structure.
$3,500?
Yeah. Yeah, but we build it from, we buy the raw materials, the steel and the lumber and, you know, and that stuff. And we bend our pipes ourselves and we teach people how to do it all over the country. But we have a crew that goes out. We have a construction division now. A crew that goes out of young people that we've trained from 18 to 24, and they can build. We've turned them into folks that couldn't even hold a hammer the right way into carpenters, and they are able to build the hoop houses, fill them with new compost, because we do not grow in existing soil at all. We have no digging equipment. We put 2 feet of new soil on top of the existing soil to grow our food in. So that's where the composting. And when I talked about the challenge, that's the biggest challenge, because we can't grow in the existing soil inside cities because there's too many contaminants.
Right.
And those contaminants go into the product that you're trying to grow. So, you know, I still see people buying rototillers trying to bouncing around, you know, on hardpan clay. And so we grow on asphalt, concrete, rooftops, our material. Can go inside pots.
So what you're saying, this is a really important point, I think, to reiterate for a moment, that the composting operation you created in agreement with your city sewage and waste system and Veolia, is how you create this 22 million pounds of compost a year.
Because the site is like the ideal site, because it's in an area that already smells. So we don't have to worry about smells.
Right.
In terms of generating that much compost, and it's in a site that was designed to hold waste 20 years ago. So we have the ideal composting site there. But we compost at other areas too. We do 1 million pounds right in the middle of the city in a static way where you don't turn.
What does that mean?
Turn the piles. You build the piles and you don't turn them.
Gotcha.
So then they don't off-gas any smells.
So it doesn't get funky.
Cap them with wood chip, and then they slowly add water and monitor the internal temperature. You want it about 150 degrees to kill all the pathogens and kill all the weed seed and everything. The other aspect of this urban agriculture that we do is you do not have weeds, because you're in a composting process, you kill all the weed seed. So, or all the whatever, tomato seeds and so forth, pepper seeds, that when you get that waste, you know, if you don't have the temperatures high enough, that seed will sprout. So when you put that compost down, you got weeds and tomato plants shooting up and squash plants, you know, wild stuff coming out of your compost. But if you compost it at 150 degrees, then it kills all of those weed seeds. So it's much more fun to plant a crop and not have to pull weeds.
Right. And your crops are organic?
Yes. We use absolutely no chemicals at all to grow about 150 different varieties of vegetables, fruit, edible flowers, and herbs.
And you raise fish, I understand,
yeah.
Right?
And that's going to increase production. We work with the Great Lakes Institute at UW-Milwaukee, and we're doing research on finfish, actually yellow perch, lake perch,
right,
that have numbers that dwindled so much in the Great Lakes that there's a moratorium on commercially fishing for them, and they're mercury contaminated. So the only way to get the favorite fish in the Midwest is to grow it on fish farms, but do it in a different way than the typical fish farm outside. It takes 3 years. We're able to bring a product to market in a year because of the consistent temperatures at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, where fish are eating all the time, and we can breed them 4 times a year versus 1 time a year.
That happens. You use the gray water for water for the gardens from the fish?
Yeah, we have a system of, we capture water off of all of our buildings, and those are fish systems as well on the exterior for fish that can survive in cold water. And we pump that water into the greenhouse, that rainwater, to be able to water a plant.
So I'm really curious if you would describe the operation of how it works in terms of how you farm. You mentioned some things. I think people hear the word, but they're not sure what it means when you talk about vertical farming and how it works. I mean, how you actually create an urban farm. What does it look like? What do you do?
Well, we've taken greenhouses, and typically when people use greenhouses, they grow on one plane. We grow, when you look at our greenhouses, if I was to describe one of our greenhouses, we have fish systems below ground, and then we build beds above, two beds above. We pump the water from the fish system through plants, and then that water gets dumped back into the same system. So that water just circulates through the system, through the plants. And in that process, the ammonia, the waste that the fish give off, gets transferred to nitrate, and the plants take up that nitrogen and get rid of that. Fast-growing plants like watercress, tomatoes, or you come up with some plants that
watercress and tomatoes make me hungry.
Yeah, and then we can market that watercress to restaurants because at $16 a pound. So you start getting product from the plants before you get the product from the fish. So these systems that basically are about 10,000 gallons of water, which can raise 10,000, say, tilapia or lake perch. Pretty dense. Gallon of water per fish is kind of the measurement that we use. So at the end of that year, you're getting about, not all the fish reach the size, so you're making about $50,000 per system that way. And it's in a space that wouldn't normally be used below ground. So we dig down and take out hundreds of yards of soil, hardpan clay, and build these systems using this rubberized material, 45 mil liner to grow the fish in. But these are closed systems. These are water conservation systems. You only add makeup water to the system as you get some evaporation.
The idea of vertical farming, I mean, that you, because you're in an urban area,
right,
you can always just spread out.
Right.
Some cities have these vast fields you can build on. Baltimore does, I know, and I guess Milwaukee has their share as well. Right.
But when you get into cities like New York, Boston, Vancouver, Tokyo, San Francisco, to feed people in the future, we're going to have to go up in the air. Now, there has never been a vertical farm built to date where you think of stacking greenhouses on top of each other, kind of the concept of 50-story. There have been a lot of architectural renderings of 50 and 100-story buildings, but nobody's ever quantified what that would cost, what kind of production would happen. So we're building the first in the world.
How big is it going to be? How tall is it going to be?
It's going to be 5 stories. And we're going to get information about, quantify a lot of things in that. And it's going to be a multi-use facility. So besides having the greenhouses, you know, we're in an old facility. We don't have office space, so it'll give us office space for our office personnel, and also space for some things like a commercial kitchen, a larger retail store, because we're in a food desert of high population, largest housing project 5 blocks away that's being reconstructed right now. The closest grocery store is 3.5 miles away. So it's a food desert. The only healthy food that we have is the food from our facility. The rest of it's corner stores and fast food operations.
You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. We'll be right back with more from Will Allen after this brief break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. And here's the rest of my interview with Will Allen, Farmer-in-Chief of Growing Power.
So one of the things I'm very interested in all this is the question of how we really transform the way people eat and people's access to food. So, as I said when we started this conversation, you know, when you think about organic food and food that's healthy, they're sold as farmers markets, they're sold upscale restaurants,
right,
and therefore the people who can afford it. I mean, I can afford it, you can afford it, but when you talk about the millions of people, 48% of Americans living in poverty or near poverty, which is a huge number, right?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, let's start with Milwaukee, with the work you're doing. I mean, can the working class people, the poor working class people, people of color in those communities afford the food that you're going to? How does that work?
Well, food, price of food is dictated by the price of production and all the other costs from shipping food. Now we're in a situation where oil prices are up.
Right.
Food prices for everybody, whether you're poor or wealthy or whatever, are going to go up, because the cost is going to be passed on to the consumer. So having a local food system makes more sense than ever before in terms of controlling the cost. We're going to have to do things like we've done with renewable energy and using, being very innovative in terms of how do we grow food. If we can do it in Milwaukee, that's why Milwaukee is a great test piece, because of the inclement weather.
Right, your northern climate.
If we can do it in Milwaukee, you can do it in Maryland, you can do it in North Carolina. I go to these states and speak, and I tell these farmers and prospective urban agriculturalists and even the rural agriculturalists, they've got it made in a lot of ways, because they can put up these high tunnels, hoop houses, and they don't have to do what we have to do. We have to put hot mix, wood chip, and things around the exterior wall so cold air doesn't enter, because all your cold air enters from the bottom. We have to put compost in the four corners. We have to cover the beds with plastic inside the greenhouses. So you have a hoop house, and then you're covering the beds, 36-inch wide beds, with plastic when it gets below 25 degrees. And we're able to grow 40 different types of greens in the wintertime without using fossil fuel. We also have solar. A quarter of our electricity gets derived from our solar system. for electricity. We heat out 70% of our water through a solar internal hot water system that we've developed. We also have an anaerobic digester to take some of the food waste and turn it into acetic acid, and then change the bacterial structure of that so that you can put it in a methane digester to produce methane and scrub it clean to run a generator to generate electricity. So we've done all that research, and our next major project in a year or so is to find a space in the city to build a large-scale digester and methane digester and generate electricity. So right now, we got into a program early on that we get 22 cents a kilowatt hour. We pay about 10.8. The only problem with that is they shut the program down.
Why? What do you mean?
The program was started by our utility company. It was a lawsuit for building a new power plant, and they got sued because of the potential pollution or whatever. And they settled by this renewable energy system that they put in for anybody who wanted to do solar or wind. They would pay out 22 cents a kilowatt hour. And a commercial project like ours gets charged 10.8. I don't know what the residential charge is, but it's lower than the commercial charge. So we have this opportunity, but the problem with that is that you have to have the money up front to be able to build a system, and most people don't have that money up front at the time. So it took us quite a few years, and we got in just under the wire. But it would have been nice to be able to have a much bigger system built, but the system we built is about a $100,000 system. Well, the two systems are about $200,000. And that's hard to come up with that kind of money today to build that kind of system for a commercial operation.
So I'm just in terms of the vision of this, because you are clearly a visionary. That's how these things happen, how you make them happen. How do you see that happening in other cities, given the tight money and where we are? I mean, this is a vision everywhere you go. I'm sure every city you visit will have people like we have in Baltimore, in Rockville, Salisbury, Newark, New Jersey, who want to do this,
right.
who have this idea
right.
that we can feed ourselves.
Right. Well, I think now we're at a time where people are very excited about local food systems, municipalities, corporate companies, banks. I mean, so many different people that need to be at the table. I think that it's really, really important that we do this together. People that you wouldn't normally, 10 years ago, that wouldn't be at the table, are now at the table and want to do this because everybody wants to build these. We have all these 2020 plans and so forth. Every city you go into, I talk to a mayor, we got a 2020 plan to become green and sustainable by 2020. Well, without a sustainable food system, without people having access to the same type of healthy food, they're never going to reach their goal because that's one of the top 10 things in their plans. Every city has food in there, a sustainable food system in there, and we're nowhere close. But everybody wants to be a part of this. Now, that's why I call this the Good Food Revolution, which is the title of my book that's coming out in May, because it's a revolution now. Young people want to be a part of it. I would say 60-70% of the folks that are now involved are under age of 40,
right?
Which it gives us a great opportunity because the enthusiasm everywhere I go. I was at Duke last week, Duke University last week, and the hall was full.
Well, I read about your thing in Duke last week. I saw that. Yeah,
and right. Everywhere I go. Or Michael Pollan, who's a friend of mine, everywhere he goes, he went to the University of Wisconsin, 8,000 people showed up at the Kohl Center to hear him speak. Even some opponents that say, this won't work. You know, Michael, this won't work. Local food systems, sustainable food systems. So when you start getting opposition, and we talk about this, that means that that's a good sign, because Big Ag is paying attention and saying it doesn't work. When nothing's been quantified, they don't know if it's going to work or not. I contend that it will work, because we've had a system like this before, and it did work, but we threw it away because cheap food. Everybody wanted cheap food. Now food is not going to be so cheap, and we're going to pay for it one way or the other, whether we pay for it up front or we pay for it on the back end of our, because we just pass on other costs to some other agency, just like Prince Charles said. We pass on to some other agency the cost of eating bad food. We pass it on to the medical community, to insurance companies, to environmental impact on our environment. You know, we're passing on those costs. So, and I believe that we can have organic pricing the same as conventional pricing if we lower our input cost in growing food sustainably, because like I said, composting, building your own facilities, there's so many ways. Renewable energy, a renewable source of energy is heating greenhouses with waste products. So we have to be very innovative. Capturing water. Water's a huge cost. We use up a tremendous amount of water in conventional industrial agriculture. So we need to cut the cost of water use by capturing rainwater and reusing that rainwater in agriculture. I mean, you know, that's what's, to me, that's exciting to be able to, and that's why young people are interested in this, because it's creative. It takes creativity to figure out how are we going to raise these fish in a building. Take a vacant building and turn it into a fish farm.
Right.
You know, some of these vacant buildings are right. Foreclosures. You can get them for a song and a dance, you know, and convert those buildings, clean them up, and all of a sudden you got a startup farm. It's much easier for a young person who wants to farm to start in a city than it is in some rural area that where the land is very expensive. Even today, with the downturn in our land prices decreasing a little bit, it's still hard for a young farmer to find land and purchase a farm. So I think starting in a city is definitely a place that they can do. And then they can expand to, because there's a lot of land in and around cities that's not being used. And there's so much asphalt and concrete. I mean, we're growing farms on asphalt and concrete.
Right.
But you got to have the one thing we talked about earlier. It's all about the soil.
Right, the compost.
It's about growing soil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're able to grow soil, you can grow healthy food that grows healthy people, that grows healthy communities. That's the way I look at it. We can do it, but we have to change the way we think, and we have to educate ourselves even more. A lot of people are getting educated around food. Organizations like this organization here at Johns Hopkins.
Center for the Liberal Future, yeah. We're talking today, yeah.
They're doing a lot of educating people about the food system. We're doing it on a different kind of way. There are multiple groups around the country, and universities, and student gardens, and youth organizations, nonprofits that are have youth programs and so forth. So, I think this is a great time. It's the best time, I think, ever in my career for making this work.
One of the things you said earlier, and again, that's something that I'm really, I think is a critical question I'm critically interested in, is you said that the price of food in the world today is artificially low because of the subsidies to Big Ag,
yeah.
Right? But those subsidies and the low cost of food is what staved off hunger and allowed people to eat in America because they could afford the food. But go ahead.
There's a big but to that. But what is the food that we're eating? Is it really good for us? The food that is coming from Big Ag, the processed foods. We've never been sicker than we are today. We have more diabetes, we have more heart disease,
right.
And cancer and everything because of the food we eat. Food in the three, if you took the three pillars of our health, so to speak, nutrition, exercise, and the other one would be stress management, right? Those are the three pillars of our health. Nutrition is about two-thirds of the of those three things. If we would get that piece right, we would be pretty healthy. If we were eating the right things, if we were getting the full impact of nutrients that we should be putting in our body to, you know, to take care of our bodies, yeah, exercise, you know, is important, and of course, stress management is important right. too, to our health. But two-thirds of that picture is nutrition, which is our food that we eat.
So, but how do we get, coming back to what I was talking about, in terms of maybe I'm just missing something, but in terms of the cost and the ability to get food to poor and working class people in this country, which is to me the core of it. We can't, you know, that.
Well, it's really about distribution. And having access, poor people will buy healthy food. We're
right.
building a new store in a food in the biggest food desert in Milwaukee. It'll be an organic store, probably the first of its kind in the nation. It's a deli, and it's below low-income housing units. They're building these new units with storefronts in Milwaukee, in a section of Milwaukee on King Drive, and we have a 2,000-square-foot store and deli that people have been waiting for. It's taken us a long time to build it out because of some structural issues with the building in terms of venting for our deli. But it'll be open in the next month.
Really?
So we need to put up more of those because many people in poor incomes have a huge knowledge of food. And we take that for granted. We think, oh, folks that are poor, they want to eat that bad food. But they don't have access to it. If you're in the winter time in Milwaukee, and you don't have a car, and you don't have, you know, you got two kids, you're a single mother, are you going to get on a bus when you have a blinding snowstorm and travel 3 miles and drag your food back to your house? Or are you going to walk down the street to McDonald's or Burger King or KFC or the corner store and get some processed food and go back to your place that's just less than a quarter mile away?
Right.
So that's the problem. It's about access. It's not, you know, I think we wrap ourselves in this thing about poor people don't know what good food is, and that's an assumption we shouldn't make because people in poor communities are very knowledgeable about, a lot of people, about their food. And there's somebody in these large families that know about food. And something's been passed on to somebody in that family that can pass it on to their family.
Because everybody's roots were in the country.
Yep.
Everybody's roots were in farming.
Yeah. So I think another assumption is kids, we say kids don't know what good food is. Kids, if I talk to kids all the time. If you ever sit down with a kid in the inner city and ask them, tell me about the last time you had a really good meal. And they'll tell you every time it happens, well, Thanksgiving, Christmas, holidays, when they go to grandma's house, or their mother fixes them a nice, you know, turkey and all the trimmings and all that stuff. And you know, they know what good food is. They just don't have a steady supply of that. They don't have access to that on a regular basis. They only get it 3 or 4 or 5 times a year. If you're only getting, it's 365 days in a year, and you're only getting a really good meal 3 or 4 or 5 times in a year, that's not nearly enough to sustain ourselves and make us healthy, because our food is medicine. We take medicine 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Some of us take good medicine, some of us take very bad medicine. So if we're, like I said before, if we're able to solve that food piece, we're going to have a healthier person. Our kids will reach that full potential. Many kids go to school without a meal, even though they have free breakfast and lunch at schools, but the kids get to school late, they don't eat breakfast, they stop at a candy store, they're wired, they can't learn.
Right.
So that's one of the biggest causes of kids not learning, is the fact that they don't get to school and they're have the full capacity to learn because of the food that they eat. So we have to fix that. The other thing that we have to fix is how do we sit in a classroom and talk about the five healthy foods, and then we march the kids down the hall to the cafeteria where we give them really lousy, some of the worst food that you could possibly eat. That's not a very good message to give our kids. We sit in the classroom and talk about this stuff, and then we march them down the hall. That, to me, that doesn't make any sense. And we've been able to get our food into the Milwaukee public school system.
Your food, those are growing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was a big, big deal. Next year, we're going to grow 250,000 pounds of carrots. That's how much the Milwaukee public schools use. These will be local carrots. They won't be rejected carrots from wherever they get them from now. So we're feeding students on sometimes less than $2 a meal. If I gave you $2 today and said, go out and buy, go anywhere, buy a healthy meal on $2.
Right.
We'd be hard-pressed to be able to do that. So how do we expect our kids to eat a meal that's $2? You know, we're allocating like $2. And I understand the school systems are strapped with that and tied, got their hands tied behind their back with those $2. But what we're able to do is to work with Sysco, which is probably the largest wholesaler in the country, a processor, growing power. We grow the carrots. We wash them. We take them to a processor. They process them. They go back to Sysco. Sysco is the only delivery system into the public school system. They're the only people that are allowed to deliver fresh fruits and vegetables. So that's how we're able to do it. And the way I was able to negotiate this, I talked to those companies and I said that this is about social and food justice. We need to give a little. Everybody has to give a little to make this work. The school board paid a little bit more. Sysco got a little bit less. The processor got a little bit less. And, of course, we got a little bit less than we would get selling it to some other customer. So everybody's got to give a little because we're in this thing together. And, when I talk to these groups, I say everybody's responsible for this thing because if we want to live in safe cities, because food is also a crime-fighting tool. Having a healthy food system, because it can create thousands of jobs. If we create this food system, it'll create thousands of jobs. We're proving that. And that's why we have to do something really concrete. We can't just go to D.C. and stand in line and put on a blue suit and lobby and say, you know, we need this healthy food. We have to prove that this works. We've got to take our policymakers out, and that's what I do. I think that's the most effective policy piece that I was able to do is build a system, take our mayor, take our legislators out to Growing Power, invite them, let them tour the facility, and then they have a picture of what a food system looks like, what a future food system could look like. But also being able to create those numbers when they ask you those questions. How are you going to cash flow this thing? How are you going to sustain this? What kind of jobs are you going to create? Are they living wage jobs? And we have all living wage jobs, you know. So that's a big piece because we're going to have to be able to, when we hire somebody, we're going to have to be able to stabilize them in a salary that they can pay their living expenses. They can pay for their house. They can pay for their car or whatever, you know, because it takes time. It takes me at least 2 years to train somebody. That's a huge investment when you think about it. It takes a long time to train a farmer or somebody in the food system, regardless of what job they're doing. It took us over a year to train these young people that are now building hoop houses on their own. A crew of them, it took over a year to train them, that they are now carpenters. They couldn't even hold a hammer. And now they can build a hoop house in 2 days.
That was Will Allen, Farmer-in-Chief of Growing Power. Up next, correspondent Tom Horton joins us to talk about spring.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva. As I write, the furnace is running and a wool shirt's still welcome. But do join me on a spring ramble. It's early, but it's time. Last week, the forsythia down the block finally gave it up, committed alchemy, just exploded goldenly, as if exhaling months of stored sunlight in one glorious burst. A bushy, bright middle finger flipped triumphantly in the face of this mean and gusty winter. High and low, the season is upon us. The guard is changing. On my evening walk, I heard spring peepers shrilling love songs from a damp gully as wild swans bayed on high, headed for tundra nesting grounds 4,000 miles away. Smoky blue masses of salamander eggs, extruded in a nocturnal orgy, float and shimmer in a friend's forest pond. An osprey's call and sky dance over the Wicomico River, back from the south as usual, just in time for St. Patrick's Day. I inspect the early blossomers, planted all around my yard several times a day, urging them, get on with it. The witch hazels led off in February, attracting bees on a freezing day. The quinces will any day now send forth an orangey-red beacon from the corner of the front yard, and the redbud by my office is just about to do itself proud. All over Delmarva, the red maples, ochre rubrum, are casting a fine, fresh blush on the forests. The great wave of light that receded in late December on the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, has rebounded almost halfway now, the light swelling on into late June and a heady 15 hours of sun on the summer solstice, longest day of the year. Generations past marked important spring events in blossom time. On Tylerton on Smith Island, the flowering of a venerable snowball bush behind the general store heralded the start of the soft crab run. In other parts of the Chesapeake, crabbers looked to start work around the locust storm when the sweet-scented flowers of the black locust tree emerged. Amelanchier canadensis, a small white-flowering tree or shrub, is known around Delmarva as shadbush. Its delicate and ephemeral white petals in April coincided with the once great runs of American shad up Chesapeake rivers. Shad that make their spawning run later in the spring are still known in some parts as poplar backs by old-timers for syncing their run with the blossoming of stately tulip poplars, one of the largest and grandest trees in our eastern forests. Another month or so and spring's lush momentum will almost overwhelm us. Dogwoods and cherries, magnolias and viburnums, a blizzard of greens throughout, except for a few stubborn black walnuts, wayward sycamores, and reluctant pecans. The forsythia down the block is pretty much a one-shot wonder. It will sink back into obscurity, gathering itself until next March, when once again I can count on it to ring old winter's bell.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.